Good morning, everybody. My name is Lori Burke, and I will be the moderator today. I'd like to welcome you to this session. So thank you for attending session 314, titled CASA Volunteering and Child Abuse in the Mormon Culture. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk at the main floor. Take advantage of our Sunstone special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of the time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. Through my volunteer work as a court-appointed special advocate, CASA, with Foster and or DCSF identified high-risk children in northern Utah, have identified patterns of child abuse within Mormon culture. This presentation will describe familiar structures that lead to cycles of abuse within Mormon families. It will also identify ways of breaking those abusive patterns and empowering abuse victims to speak out, all while focusing on maintaining biological and family structures as well as possible. And obviously that is not me, that is our presenter. Okay, the presenters will speak in the following order. We only have one today, and it's Marissa McPeck Stringham. She is the information and research specialist at the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome. She received her bachelor's degree in social work from Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, and is a licensed social worker in the state of Utah. Thank you very much, and if you could please give your attention to the speaker.
Thank you. I don't really want to do like a question and answer period at the end, so if you have questions throughout, I guess there's a microphone right up here. Just come grab it. I hate when I'm in a presentation and I have a question and then I have to wait till the end and then I forget it because I have ADD. So, all right, to begin, it's actually... Okay, great. Thank you.
Maybe not.
Oh, well, it was a good thought. So I'm presenting today about my work as a CASA volunteer that's a court-appointed special advocate here in northern Utah. I'm in the 2nd District, which is Weber, Davis, and Morgan County. I'm on my 3rd case. I've been doing it for 3 years, and every family that I've worked with is LDS or has an LDS background. So... just to begin, I do want to start with a trigger warning. I'm sensitive to that. I'm going to be talking about child abuse, a little bit of sexual abuse, and also I'm not going to show any pictures of any abused children. Confidentiality is key. I'm not even allowed to post pictures on Facebook with me and my CASA kids that I work with. Because they are either in foster care or identified by DCFS as a family in need of services. So I just want to put that out there. I have been in, like the moderator said, I work for the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome, and I have been in conferences where I have not been warned, and all of a sudden up on the screen pops pictures of severely abused children or... the after effects of a child being shaken, a baby being shaken, and it's not something you ever get used to, and I don't like to shock people like that. So just to start off with, Does anybody know or have heard of what a CASA does before coming today? Only on a volunteer basis. So we work with the guardian ad litem, who is the child's attorney. So when a family is identified by DCFS, that's Department of Division of Child and Family Services, as a family that needs services, the mother gets an attorney, the father has an attorney, and the guardian ad litem represents the child in court. So when I've gone to court with my cases, I've sat up front, I've sat on the same table as the guardian ad litem. So what we are supposed to do is advocate for the best interests of the child who are in the court system. So I'm on my third case, and they've all been so different. So the first case, it was two little boys, and they were in foster care. The foster parents were a little older, more of a retired age, and they could not handle the energy of not only young boys, but boys who were traumatized. And it took me probably about 3 or 4 months of visits before the older boy, who was only like, I want to say 11 months older than his little brother. They were super close in age, before he opened up to me and told me what it was like the day that that the police came and took his mom for abuse and neglect and drug use, and what that was like for him as this little 5-year-old thinking that he was never going to see his mother again. I had to do a lot to earn his trust. So, I'm sorry, it's awkward standing up here because I'm used to, like, walking around and talking. So, but for recording purposes, I'll try and stand still. So what a CASA has to do in Utah is you have to have 30 hours of training. When I did it, it was 2 nights a week for 3 hours for a month. We went to training. We sat in court and watched court cases. We talked to guardian ad litems. We had other CASAs come in, talk about their experiences. We had to pass a background check. You have to be 21 years old. Not everyone gets accepted as a CASA. My supervisor was telling me about this guy who kept saying that he was in the training and he only wanted to be put with, like, teenage girls, and so she had to, sorry, you know, your background check was good, but I have to use my instincts here to say no. So not everyone who trains gets to actually be put with cases. So are we looking at this slide too long? Sorry. So what we do is we visit with the child at least twice a month. The guardian ad litems don't really get to see them that often. They're deluged with cases. The last two guardian ad litems I've worked with have had over 100 cases just by themselves. And that's crazy to me to think that there's that many children in need of a guardian ad litem just in a little small three-county area. I love the visiting with the child. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Can you quickly explain the difference between a CASA volunteer and a guardian ad litem? Because I know they're related, but I don't know the exact difference.
Okay, so guardian ad litem is an attorney. They've gone to law school. I don't mean to brag, but I'm not an attorney. So, no, I'm just kidding. I like to say that because my sister is. So they work for the state, so they're employed by the state. A CASA can come from any walk of life. You know, I'm a social worker, so a lot of the training came easy to me because it was something that I already knew and worked with. There were women in my class who were, you know, district managers of stores that just wanted to give back with their time. There were women who worked in schools as, like, secretaries, so they already had, like, bonds with children. So a guardian ad litem is the attorney employed by the state, and a CASA is just a citizen from the community. That's why I say anybody can do it if you can pass a background check and you're not sketchy and have good interests at heart. So did that answer your question? Okay. So another one of our responsibilities while we're visiting the children is to gather information. So we have to, I kind of think of it as you keep your ears open and your mouth shut. So it's a lot of observing. What are the parents saying if you're in the visits with the parents? My second case, the mother, I didn't get involved in the case until 4 months after the children had been removed and they were in foster care with their grandparents. And the mother worked her tail off doing everything that she could to get her kids back. So by the time I was involved, they were actually back home with their mom within 4 months. And most DCFS cases, they take a year to resolve. So she really worked hard to do that. So, but I listened a lot to what she said because the caseworkers with DCFS and the guardian ad litem were very concerned that she was, even though they had initiated divorce proceedings, was going to get back with the father who had issues with child pornography, and there was some question about whether or not he had done some things to the kids. So they were very concerned that she was still wanting to be back with him. So I kind of had to keep my ears open and listen really closely to the things that she said. So, and then document. You have to document all of your findings. So the kids that I have had haven't been in school yet, but they've been in daycare. So I called the daycare and asked, you know, what are your observations from the teachers there? We do an education report that gets sent to the judge. I haven't done one yet because I haven't had any kids in school. They always give me the little kids. So you talk to the teachers and talk to the important people in this child's life, is the therapist, and all that information gets sent back to the guardian ad litem. Like I said, they're inundated with cases. They're not always real connected. A lot of times they are, but they're not always real connected with the nitty-gritty details of what's going on. So one of the things that I like to do is attend court because I feel like I get a lot more information there. It's kind of funny. I found out just DCFS and foster parents just don't communicate very well with each other. My very first case, I had the foster parents telling me one thing and the caseworker telling me another thing, and it wasn't until I got to go to court that I'm like, okay, this is actually what's going on. So a lot of times the judges will ask the CASAs to stand up and speak. I haven't been asked to do that, thank goodness, because I don't want to do that. So I'm kind of going out on a limb talking about it with you guys right now. So so another thing is you got to explain what's going on. That's what's so important to the guardian ad litem. Whenever I had a visit, immediately I'd go back to my car and I'd write down everything that I could think of that I thought was notable or noteworthy for from that visit, because there's, you just know, never too much detail. And another important thing is to be the glue of the case. CASAs are really the only ones who are there more frequently than the caseworkers and the guardian ad litems. And like I talked about, being an educational advocate and all that stuff. So, and it's important to maintain a consistent and regular visiting schedule. A lot of times you're the only stable adult this child has ever seen, has ever interacted with. With my second case, I was talking to a friend about just a little bit about my visit, because, you know, confidentiality is key. And I was saying that my little CASA girl loved to color with me or build puzzles. So I'd always bring, like, just for even from the dollar store, like a little puzzle. And she had to be in consistent control of what puzzle pieces I was allowed to place versus what puzzle pieces she was allowed to place. Or if we were coloring, this is the marker that Marissa gets, this is what she gets. And even with, like, I brought sidewalk chalk on one of my very first visits, and just what she wanted me to draw on the sidewalk chalk, and I was dumb and wore white pants that day, so that was a disaster. But anyway, so I was telling my friend this, and they were kind of surprised that I would let this child just control it. And I was like, you know, I don't think this child has had a whole lot of control over their life. So if she wants to tell me what color of crayon I'm going to use on this part of this picture, you know, that's her way of maintaining some semblance of control over her chaotic life at only 5 years old. So, all right. Any questions so far? Okay. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, about. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There are a lot more women who volunteer. I'm sorry if I gave the impression that men shouldn't be CASAs. Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, the two judges that I've been with haven't really, they kind of just rely on the guardian ad litem to talk. This new case that I'm on, the guardian ad litem warned me that she does like to hear from the CASAs, so I've got to brush up on being more articulate in front of people. So, it's recommended we do twice a month. I usually volunteer. We keep track of our hours, and it could be anywhere between like 5 and 12 hours a month between visits and drive time and preparing for the visits. And that's all the hours put together, yeah. So, like I said, I'm in Utah. It sounds like you're in Colorado, so that's great that it is a nationwide program, but each state runs it differently. So there are about 1,300 foster adoptive families in Utah. So those are families who are wanting to provide foster care or wanting to do foster to adoption, and 2,700 children, Utah children, currently in foster care. So there's half as many homes as there are children in need of a foster placement. So CASAs are important because they can be that glue. They can be that consistent person in the child's life. And CASAs are asked to stay with the case for the entirety. So when I've been assigned a case, I kind of knew in advance it would be a year. My last case, my second case, ended before the year was up, and it was really hard for me because I just grew to love those two little kids so much. I like to say that being a CASA has both expanded and broken my heart at the same time. So, excuse me, I need to. So Utah has a pretty good record of reunification with the biological families. It's about 55%, which is a slightly higher than other states. I know DCFS here works really hard. Their main goal is family reunification, and if that's possible, that's what they work towards. But at the second time, they have a backup goal, which is finding a permanent placement for these children. So my case right now, both my previous cases have concluded with the children being reunified with their biological mother, which is the best case scenario. That's what we want. We want, you know, it's very important for children to, when possible, stay with their biological families. This case that I'm on right now is kind of breaking my heart because the parents will show up to visits, but they're not doing any of the services. They have no interest in doing drug court and trying to get off drugs. They're not interested in going to family counseling. They're not interested in changing anything. And so what can you do if you can't return them to an environment where they are three little children going from homeless shelter to homeless shelter, all three of them, and we're talking so little, had genital fungal infections, which are not just bad hygiene. Those children have probably been sexually abused. And to see, you know, I'm a mother of four children, and to see somebody who isn't that invested in wanting to be reunified with their child is heartbreaking for me. And so they're working on getting the maternal grandparents to adopt these kids so they have that tie to their maternal family. So one thing in Utah is that Latino children are overrepresented in foster care. About 25% of the children in foster care are Latino, while the population of Utah is only 13% Latino. So somebody smarter than me could probably study that and delve into that and figure out why. But there's a big need for Spanish-speaking CASAs. My very first case, the two little boys were Latino, but they didn't speak Spanish, so I was able to help them, but there was still the cultural aspect that I was kind of missing. So what's interesting is that Utah ranks eighth in child abuse rates, and we're not that big of a population. Less than 3 million, but Utah ranks first in child sex abuse cases, and there's a different kinds of theories why that is. Yeah. I am not sure. Yeah. It's got to be per capita. Yeah. So the organization that I work for started out through Prevent Child Abuse Utah, and the head of it, Carrie Jensen, has said that she thinks that one of the reasons why you kind of see those numbers is because we have tougher laws than any other state. And we may pursue child abuse more vigorously. We have you heard of the Children's Justice Centers that are all up and down the Wasatch Front? Okay, so they employ a nurse that examines all of the children. If they're worth examining, sometimes there's not any abuse that is going to require a nurse, but they have dedicated staff, and they kind of are a community liaison where it's a safe place for law enforcement officers to interview these children in a comfortable environment. The one we have up in Ogden is in this old, gorgeous mansion, and there's toys everywhere, and all of the rooms are very childlike, and it's kind of cool how they do it. They have kind of not like hidden cameras, because if you point them out, you can see them, but that way, you know, you're able to talk to the child, get down on their level, and they're not camera in my face. And so the nurse had a, when I was there, we had a question about, doing exams on the genital region of a child, because you don't want to be more invasive of a child who's done abuse. And she said most of sexual abuse of children under the age of 10 There's no penetration, so you just take pictures and shine a spotlight, and they are very careful about telling them before they touch them. They don't really, she said the whole exam in the general region takes like 5 seconds, because it's just take a picture, try to collect any DNA that might be there or anything like that. Yeah, it was really traumatizing for me to go there, and I deal with child abuse every day. So in 2014 in Utah, there were 6,900 child abuse cases. 27% were sexual abuse and 13% were neglect. So that's according to the child maltreatment report, 2014 report. That's the latest report. This is a report I rely on heavily at work too, because they track infant abusive head trauma cases as well. Okay. So has anybody heard of Dr. Bruce Perry and any of the work? Okay, great. You know he's fantastic then. So for anybody who hasn't, Dr. Bruce Perry, he is based out of, he's chief of psychiatry at Texas Children's Hospital. He is a senior fellow at Child Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas. And he has researched the effect of childhood trauma on children since 1993. And if you could read any book by him, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog is fantastic. So there's kind of, and how he kind of relates to Mormon culture is he worked a lot on the YFC ranch when they did the raid and removed all those children. He worked on a lot of those custody cases. But one thing I found most fascinating in reading Dr. Bruce Perry's literature is there's this belief that children are resilient and they just bounce back quickly and they can go through anything and that they'll be fine. And what he has found over the last 23 years is that our trauma actually changes the neural pathways in our brain. And how we relate to things. That's why you will find people who, once they've been victimized once, they're more likely to be victimized again, because they don't think the way that people who haven't experienced early childhood trauma think. And he's got a couple of interesting cases in his book. I believe the boy who he talks about in the title, the man who was raising him, I don't remember if it was his father or a relative who was raising him, and he had no idea how to raise him, and so he just raised him like he raised his dogs and kept him in a cage, and not all the time. He treated him fairly well, considering he slept in a crate, but how that affected him. The one that stuck out the most to me was a mother who was a stay-at-home mom, and she had a little toddler and a baby, and she was completely overwhelmed by toddler and baby, and so she would take her little toddler on walks all day long and leave the baby alone with in his crib, you know, feed him a bottle before he left, feed him a bottle when she got back, like in time for the dad to come home from work. And so it emphasized to him how much babies need that interaction. They need to be stimulated through touch and talking and being held, and because the baby grew up to be basically a sociopath who could kill and feel no emotion. So it's that childhood neglect. You know, he wasn't hit, he wasn't anything like that, but just not having the parental interaction as a baby altered the chemicals in the neural pathways in his brain that much. So attachment and bonding are very, very important for healing the past traumas that these children face as they're being removed or, you know, shuffled around from foster home to foster home. Okay, I'm going pretty quickly, so if no one minds if we leave early... No one's going to mind? Okay. All right. So some patterns of child abuse that I've kind of seen with the three families that I've worked with that all identify as LDS in some way or Mormon in some way is, you know, there's the neglect, there's physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. But one thing is spiritual abuse. I think one thing that's unique to religious communities is that spiritual abuse may not be, it's not usually intended. Parents aren't trying to abuse their children. They're just trying to save that child from damnation, or, you know, we all want to be in the celestial kingdom together and no empty seats at the table kind of thing. Some sort of spiritual abuse, you know, demanding obedience, you know, and a child is not worthy if they're not obedient, that sort of thing. There's a lot of culture of shame and fear and exclusion, and exclusionary language, like we are the one true church, and so a lot of times church members or the comfort of other church members are put before a child's needs or their child's best interests. So if any of you have visited the Facebook page, Mormon Child Abuse Awareness, I don't know if anybody's, they have a, oh, you have, okay. They also have a blog. It's a page or in a blog that I could get lost in for hours because it's amazing how much abuse goes on within families, but also, you know, when you get ecclesiastical leaders involved. And we, it's going on all around us, and we don't even really notice it or acknowledge it. It's so ingrained in us that you rely on the, you know, the bishop to answer all your questions, and you put so much trust and faith in this person who has a mantle of the priesthood, and they can abuse you. So if you have time to visit that Facebook page, it's a good one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Yeah.
It's church-wide. Anytime you have an imbalance of power, you know, structure like that, there's a difference.
Definitely. Okay, so breaking the cycle of abuse. A lot of abuse occurs when parents have unreal expectations of what children can do at any given age. They expect 2-year-olds to be able to go potty when they really can't go potty. Or one thing that always would drive me crazy about going to my ward was demanding that young children sit very still and very quiet for hours when they were not capable of it, and that's crazy to me. I have a 3-year-old, and there's no way she would even sit for an hour with her arms folded and be quiet. It's just not, she's not capable of it. It's not because she's naughty, it's not because she's bad, it's because she's physiologically and not brain developed enough to do that. So one way to break this cycle of abuse is to learn what is age appropriate and what is not. Developing new parenting skills. My husband and I, we have 4 children. 2 of them have diagnosed ADHD, and we were kind of at a point where we didn't know what to do anymore. And so we took classes on love and logic parenting. We went to counseling with our oldest daughter with a counselor who was familiar with ADHD, who helped teach us how to parent her better. So taking classes, I don't think there's any shame in taking parenting classes and learning new ways to parent children. And that's one of the things I like about DCFS offers that at their Christmas box houses. Another good thing is to take care of yourself, especially if you are a parent that is with young children all of the time. It can be overwhelming and demanding on your emotional capacity. So being able to take a break, call a friend, get somebody to babysit once in a while. I know for me it's really hard to reach out and say I need help, but it's important to do that. and getting professional help, whether that's a counselor or a teacher or learning how to control your emotions. I work in infant abuse, and the number one trigger for infant abuse is crying. And so learning how to not react to, you know, especially if you have a high crier, reacting to the incessant crying and being able to take a deep breath and put the baby down in a safe place and walk away is really, really important to breaking that cycle. So preventing child abuse. One thing that I learned in one of the conferences that I went to that was really good was as part of my CASA training was we teach kids like good touch, bad touch, and that's probably not the best way to go about it. It's probably better to do good touch, secret touch. So if somebody's touching you in some way and asking you to keep it secret, that's what the red flag is. So with my kids, I don't do good touch, bad touch anymore. It's good touch, secret touch, and that's something that I've used with my CASA kids as well. Yeah, you don't want that because one of the things that's really shameful for sexual abuse survivors is in the moment it feels pleasurable. And so you get a lot of shame with that. If this was bad, then how come it felt so good? And not all of it, not all sexual abuse feels good, but a lot of the times that will happen. Speaking out, I think one thing is our leadership just needs to learn how to report. So full disclosure, I worked for LDS Family Services for almost 7 years, and I worked in adoption, so I didn't do a lot of the counseling, but I had some clients that I worked with that I just couldn't believe what their bishop was telling them or having them repent for. And there was a couple of times that I was told by my boss to call the bishop's hotline, which was funny because I called the bishop's hotline and they're like, you're a female. I was like, I know. I work at LDS Family Services and they told me to report. And I think the bishop's hotline is an excellent way to go about that. Within hours, I had them calling me back with an attorney and saying, definitely report this situation to DCFS. And everything, but I'm wondering how many bishops think that they know better and they don't call. And from what I could find out, there's not a whole lot of training for bishops when it comes to abuse. So, and then you have this patriarchal system where I have so many people that I know of where the church protected the abuser and then shamed the abused into forgiving. Yeah, Sarah?
Yeah, so I just recently watched Spotlight. You know,
okay, yeah, I haven't seen it, but it's on my list. I'm sorry. Give us a 20-minute synopsis. Ooh, Netflix.
Okay, so Spotlight is about the abuse, child abuse in the Catholic Church. And how much they hid that. Like, they just relocated the priests to different areas. They were only there for a couple of years, and the church knew it. They hid it. So I'm wondering how much of our church, how similar we are. Do we know? I mean, we know that this is happening. The awoke people know that it's happening, but have you found, how do I ask the question? Have you found that there's, that we're hiding behind that we're not actually, I'm sorry, I'm trying to frame it in a way that makes sense to everyone else because it makes sense in my brain, but are we hiding it? Are we saying that it's not as prevalent as it actually is in our religion.
Well, and didn't the church just come out and say they had the gold standard on preventing child abuse, and all of us, yeah, kind of like uncomfortable laughter. Yeah, that's, yeah.
So I'm a therapist in Phoenix, and I work with this population, and I don't remember the exact number, but the last time I heard, we have 17,000 kids in wow. CS custody or care, something like that. And so I was talking with the Mormon Mental Health Association yesterday, and one of the things that they're pushing for is all bishops to get mental health training, which I think would greatly help.
That.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked at LDS Family Services, we had a young woman that placed her child for adoption who had, and I actually told this on the podcast with Lindsay, this story. She had gone on a date with a return missionary in a ward. She really didn't like him that much, but, you know, you don't turn down the invitation to go on a date with a return missionary, and he sexually assaulted her. And she went to the bishop to report it. And he was, oh, you must have seduced him. A return missionary would have never done that to you. So then she becomes pregnant from the assault. And she, you know, went to the bishop again, still trusting in his counsel and like she was raised to do. And he counseled her to marry her rapist, basically. And she went to her parents just flabbergasted that this would be the counsel. And this kind of goes into your suggestion of bishops need to have some mental health training, because anybody in our field would know, like, what on earth are you doing? And so she went to her parents, and they went to the stake president, who was related to them somehow, I can't remember, I think he was her uncle, to complain about this, and he stuck by the side of the bishop. And so then, because he was, you know, their highest priesthood leader, then the parents kind of took their side, took the church's side over her side. She was a minor, 16 or 17. They got married, I can't even imagine. And he ended up leaving her 8 months into the pregnancy, and there she was by herself, traumatized and assaulted, and her church had betrayed her, and she had no way to care for this child, and ended up placing the child for adoption. And then I think a couple years later, she had was involved in an open adoption, and the adoptive parents had closed it. So then she experienced a re-traumatizing. So, and I think they were counseled to do that by priesthood leaders who didn't understand the dynamics of that. So.
So I assume you probably have a mixed audience here.
Yeah. Okay. That's an excellent book. All right, just I only have like a couple slides left, so if there's other comments, I really welcome them. Okay.
Better
Yeah.
As soon as this topic comes up, it's hands off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because of the mental and different personalities. I mean, we've all had, or those who are still going to church or have been to church, have leadership group that where you have a great bishop who would take training to part and another would say, yeah, but that trainer was a woman, and, or, you know, I know better because God is telling me. So I, as much as I think that's wonderful, in
Lori.
Okay, I was just going to say I agree with this woman here because I go to things like this, and it's not just child abuse, it's not just, you know, abuse in general, it's anytime I go to something involving power and bishops, it's always the bishops need training. There are too many things for all the lay bishops in the church to get training for. The training they need is, here's a list of things that when they come up, you transfer to professional. And so I have to agree with you that you cannot train a lay bishop in all of these issues. All you can do is say, this is outside of your stewardship, call this number, and we take it over from there. So I'm just backing you up.
Or report it.
I think report it to
where it needs to be reported.
It needs to go outside the church structure to the legal authorities.
I agree. But I'm saying that there are so many things that I think the training needs to be when it's no longer your problem, when it's a legal problem, when it's called the bishop hotline. But these people, it's like amateur hour, and I don't think you can train 20,000 amateurs repeatedly every 5 years to do this. It's just logistically impossible.
Do you want to come up to the mic?
This is a problem that is in many churches. I'm from Community of Christ, and we have the same concerns. One of the things we have put in place is trying to prevent the occurrence in the first place. And we have, I'm one of the trainers for the Child and Youth Protection Program. We are not allowed at a church function to be alone with someone under the age of 18. In some states, it's 21. And that is, remove the opportunity. Now, obviously, it's not going to work in every case, but you can greatly eliminate abuse when you take people out of that position. And at the same time, you're also protecting the adults from false accusations.
So I agree. I think that the first step is training. Like, don't ask a rape victim, what did you do? I think the first step is training bishops. Don't say anything. Go to a professional. I think it's great to prevent it in the first place, but I think, like a lot of things in the church, we have a long way to go, and I'm not sure top-down that's going to happen immediately. So I think taking these first initial steps, that's kind of what I was saying with that. Thank you.
And I think those of us that mentioned training for the for those leaderships, those in leadership positions, and I would include Relief Society presidencies in that, but also as well as policy. We weren't saying to the exclusion of policy changes, for instance, allowing young women, say, to be interviewed by a woman, things like that. But I agree with you. It may be a long time. Unfortunately, the church is always 20 to so, I don't know how many years behind. Whether you look at blacks or women, I mean, just to be realistic. I had a couple things. I wanted to compliment you, though I'm a little disturbed by your friend or whoever it was, that your instincts were good enough to, when you played with a child, to let them be in control. That's my de facto thing, and seems like that's, if you've never played with a child any other way, it's on their turn. You enter their world of play, and that's when kids love you as a playmate, when you take instructions for them. And I would just suggest, I thought we all knew that, but evidently some people questioned your instincts there. I'm surprised. I'd be open to anyone's insights. I recently had a friend, she hadn't been I didn't know her very well, and I originally knew her from the church, and she's since left the church, and myself as well, and we became better friends now that she's divorced and whatever, and she's 10 years younger than me, to just give you a perspective. Came from a big Mormon family, and I'm still dealing with this revelation she gave to me, that in her family, a very strict Mormon family, but very, on the surface, maybe joyful, and she was beaten with a belt. All the kids, the 8 kids, were beaten with a belt by the mother, who was a Relief Society president. So I tend to think, oh, this abuse happens in, families, I don't know, the marginal family somehow. But this was a super active family, temple going, all this stuff. And the kind of things they were beaten for was like spilt milk and stuff. And then there was incestuous relationships. And when initially the son was abusing the 4 daughters, and then the mother's nephews came to visit for a few months. They were maybe 18 and 20, and would abuse their cousins, I guess they'd be. But when the family found out, and she blames mostly her mom, but we would never shame the family by making that. You would be shaming the family. And she said, I got beat for the smallest thing. Could I imagine how I would be beat if I spoke up to my seminary teacher or a school counselor? So, man, now as adults, if she ever brings it up, it's squashed in the family. Can't you leave that bad past behind us? It's not healthy. We need to look forward. And I'm just taking it all in and just dumbfounded. I have no advice. I have no experience. And as far going back to CASA, just for those that don't know, that unification, when I was thinking about being a CASA volunteer, which I haven't taken that step, but that idea of how they prioritize reunification disturbed me a little bit, because I knew that wasn't always the best thing. And you made it pretty clear, but one thing I had to be reassured by the CASA, the paid CASA people, and by my friends who do it, is they don't do that if it's, like you're saying, the people that don't want, they have to jump through lots of hoops, get lots of training, take drug tests, get urine tests, have urine tests if there's drug problems. And so they make good sure it's a good place. It's not just, you're a blood relative, we got to get you back, back with your blood relatives. But anyway, so let me give it back to you.
You actually spoke on just one of the things I want to touch on is we need to, in our church, make space for victims. Sorry, somebody's waving at me. Make space for victims to allow them to share their stories and for their stories to be okay. You mentioned, don't shame this family, keeping the family secret. And that happens, across faith spectrums or whatever. We need to teach our children to respect personal spaces, teach about consent, and establish healthy boundaries and tolerate differences between, I have some friends who don't hug, and I'm a hugger, so I have to remind myself not to just hug because that's important. Some people have experienced trauma and they don't like to be touched. So I just kind of wanted to end on that. And if there's any other comments, I just want to thank everyone for your comments. Anything else? Do you want to come up and talk to the microphone? Okay.
I'm not a counselor, so I'm a lay person in this. And I'm just wondering if there's something that I could read or find that defines abuse. Because I think there's different levels of abuse. I had a bishop in my daughter's seminary class talk about patience, and he gave this analogy about sex. And it was this sexual, how he and his... Anyway, I won't go into it, but I found it very inappropriate. And so I think to myself, is that abuse? Does my daughter get up and walk away? How can I educate myself on the levels of abuse?
That would definitely be a boundary violation to use that with teenagers. That's a really good question. How do you define abuse? And I'm not sure I know how to answer that because, especially with CASA work, we don't remove children from homes for emotional abuse. We don't remove them from homes for spiritual abuse. We remove them from homes when they have bruises on their body, either there's broken bones or there's traumatic brain injuries from, you know, blunt force head trauma, which is actually way more common than I knew about. You know, we remove children from homes when there's sexual abuse or within the part of my, what was the situation with my second case was the father got busted for tons of child pornography. So, you know, when it comes to things like that, that's definitely a boundary violation. I don't know if... that's abuse. It's definitely not okay, but I don't know how much. I guess it depends on the person and how much trauma that would cause. NASW. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. Boundaries, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk about this more, but it is, yeah. Trust your instincts, yeah. All right, well, thank you. We need to get ready for the next session. So thank you for coming.